now you can decide how justified you think that was. Thank you so much for this opportunity to talk this morning. I don't have anything to disclose. So the objective of this study was to determine the impact of state laws requiring ignition interlock devices for all convicted drunk drivers, including first offenders, on alcohol-involved crash deaths. So as everybody most definitely already knows, alcohol-impaired driving is dangerous. Just at the legal limit of 0.08, a driver is already 13 times more likely to crash than a sober person. And drunk driving is also still really common. There's about 112 million drunk driving trips on the road every year in this country, which is something like 1 in 2,000 of all the trips that are driven, which is a lot. Very, very few of these result in arrest and conviction, about 1 million convictions a year. Alcohol is involved in 30% of all fatal crashes, killing about 11,000 people every year. And rates have really remained fairly stable in terms of proportions since the early 1990s. Now, effective policy can prevent alcohol-impaired driving. Blood alcohol content limits for drivers, the minimum legal drinking age, have both really made a difference, along with a sort of variety of enhanced enforcement patrols and penalties. But all of these policies have some major limitations in that they rely either on intoxicated individuals to decide not to drive when their judgment is already impaired, and they rely on police to identify and stop intoxicated drivers, and police just can't be everywhere all the time. What this means is that the average person who's arrested for drunk driving has already driven 88 times drunk before without getting caught. The other problem is that the usual penalty is a suspended license, and unfortunately 50 to 75% of drunk drivers whose licenses are suspended continue to drive, maybe partly because they know they can get away with it and partly because they may just not have adequate alternative transportation, you know, even when they're sober. So ignition interlocks represent a pretty different approach. They look something like that. They are installed attached to the ignition, and they require the driver to pass a breath analysis test before the car will start. The technology became practical in the 90s, and use has been increasing from about 100,000 in 2006 up to more than 300,000 on the road now. But this is still representing only about a quarter of drunk driving convictions. And they do work, at least by some measures. Interlocks have been shown to reduce drunk driving recidivist arrests by 50 to 90%. But there's really minimal direct evidence on crashes and crash outcomes. To my knowledge, no study has directly looked at injuries or deaths. And of three studies examining crashes, the results have really been mixed. In terms of the policy landscape, every state uses interlocks in some situations, usually for repeat offenders or people with very high BACs. Sometimes it's at a judge's discretion or something like that. But starting in 2004 and going up through 2013, 18 states expanded this requirement to cover all drunk drivers, including first offenders at all illegal BAC levels. And those are those blue states that you see pretty well distributed around the country, actually. There have been another, I believe, four states in the last couple of years after our data was collected. So the objective of our study, again, was to assess the impact of this universal interlock requirement, the all-offender law, on alcohol-involved crash deaths. We used a difference-in-difference analysis, which I'll talk about a little bit more. The population was just the population of the 50 states from 1999 through 2013. We used publicly available data from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration Fatality Analysis Reporting System, FARS, and we collected the state policies from the Trust for America's Health and confirmed them with state legislative records and highway offices. The primary outcome was alcohol-involved crash deaths per 100,000 population during this time period. And the primary predictor was the presence of a universal interlock requirement. The additional predictors that we incorporated were state-fixed effects, so one binary variable for each of those 50 states encapsulating everything that makes your state special that doesn't change over time. So the sort of population makeup of the state, how rural it is, the size, all of this stuff is incorporated there, as well as year effects to kind of encapsulate change over time across the country, and a couple of potentially relevant time-varying state characteristics. So these are things like the state highway speed limit, how many vehicle miles were driven in that state, stuff like that, a couple of other traffic safety policies. And we use generalized linear modeling to account for the skewed outcome and clustered within states over time. So I don't know how familiar people are with the difference in differences analysis, but bear with me if you're very familiar. It's a quasi-experimental design that has its roots in economics, where it's used pretty commonly, but it's kind of spreading out into other types of policy studies. So there's really three differences that we talk about. Difference A, over there in that sort of schematic that I made up, is the pre-post difference in the states that adopted the policy. But as you can see in this diagram, we can't credit that whole difference to our policy. It's too big. Things were going down anyway. So difference B is the difference that occurred in the states that never had the policy over the same period of time. And that's where we account for sort of secular trends that are taking place across the country. And the difference in differences is essentially just A minus B. So people always say this is an attempt to mimic a randomized controlled trial, which it is, of course, but you can also think of it the other way. A randomized controlled trial is a special case of a difference in difference analysis. You do the same thing. You have a treatment, a control, you measure before, you measure after, you compare the differences, you just have randomization in that case, which is awesome. We don't have that here. So this is what we found. This is just a table showing you that overall states with and without the universal interlock requirement were pretty similar, maybe a little bit concentrated in the west of the country, as you saw in the map, a little bit less rural, maybe drive a little bit less, nothing significant here. These are not, as you can see at the bottom, all red states or all blue states either, which is notable. I'm looking at the unadjusted death rates. Nationally, that's the gray line. Things started out with about 6 alcohol-involved crash deaths per 100,000 around 1999, stayed pretty flat for the first couple years before coming down to around 4.5 at the end of the study period. And in the states that didn't adopt the policy in orange, things look pretty similar. They kind of follow along the same line. And the light blue line is the states that adopt the policy. It's a little hard to follow because in 2004, it's just one state which had a low death rate. And then as additional states pass the law and join in, it goes up before sort of gradually starting to come down by the end of our time period. And using our difference in differences results, we found a 15.1% reduction in alcohol-involved crash deaths in states with the policy compared to those without, which calculates out to approximately 915 lives saved in universal interlock requirement states starting in 2007. Did I skip something? I did. This is a good slide. So we looked at time trends, and we compared our adopting states to our states that didn't have the policy before 2004 to kind of get the sense that they were doing similar things, and they were. There was no significant difference. And then we also looked at what happened each year after the policy was adopted. And as you can see in this adjusted graph on the left, that there's very small decreases in the years 1 and 2 after the policy, followed by a pretty substantial decrease in year 3, which stays pretty consistent throughout the rest of the study period. So we incorporated a 3-year time lag into our analysis for the rest of what I'm going to tell you. And like I just said, we saw a 15% reduction in deaths after that time period, resulting in states with the policy having an average adjusted crash death rate of 4.7 per 100,000 compared to 5.5 in states without, with a p-value of 0.02 for that difference. We also did a couple of checks on the validity of our model. We looked at the overall motor vehicle crash death rate and found a very similar difference. And we also looked at the rate of death from crashes not involving alcohol. You wouldn't expect to see an effect, and luckily we did not see an effect. Just to put this in a little bit of context with other traffic safety measures that we think are important. So seatbelts are the best, and some sort of a rough calculation, they save about 4 lives per 100,000 people every year. Airbags, which we believe in and are standard on all cars, save about 0.9 lives per 100,000 people. The minimum legal drinking age, which is an important measure, but it's much lower. It's about 0.2 lives, and there's our 0.8 on the right for the ignition interlock requirement. It's really very comparable, I think. So, of course, there's some limitations I should discuss. There's variation both between and within states as far as how these policies are enforced. There may be local laws that we couldn't take account of that were more strict than the state laws. And there's other various features of interlock programs that vary between states that we couldn't really account for either. We also cannot fully rule out another policy or another unobserved causal factor that was correlated both with our policy and with the outcome that could have contributed to the change. And although a diverse group of states have adopted the requirement, of course, past performance is never a guarantee of future success, so we don't really know what would happen in the remaining now 28 states. But nonetheless, I think this has some important implications for public policy. So drunk driving remains a leading cause of injury death in the U.S. Requiring ignition interlock devices for all convicted drunk drivers led to a decreased rate in death from alcohol-involved crashes. So I would certainly recommend expanding this policy to the remaining 28 states, and the CDC recommends this too now. But there's more that we can do. There's a great study from earlier this year from Patrick Carter and colleagues looking at what would happen if we required ignition interlocks in all new cars, the way we do with seatbelts and airbags and all these other things. And they found that we would reduce crash deaths by about 85% in 15 years. And there's no reason not to take that seriously, like I said, as we have done with seatbelts, airbags, all these other safety devices. Short of that, we can expand financial assistance and monitoring programs to make sure that everybody who's supposed to have an interlock actually has one. Can offer insurance incentives to encourage voluntary use. They could be incorporated into graduated licensing laws for young adults, all these things. It's also worth noting that faster, less obtrusive interlock technologies are in development, which will make all these measures easier. So thank you very much. And I'd also like to thank Doug Weeb, my research mentor, and Andy Epstein for a ton of help with the methods. I have some references. I'll take any questions. Thanks. That's not a question. There was someone over there. There's two people over there. Yeah.
Thank you. Great talk. I might have missed, did all the states implement the law at the same time?
Yeah, I may not have been clear about that. They did not all adopt them at the same time. The first was in 2004, and then every year after that, there have been additional states. So each state is compared to itself with its own pre and post and to the non-adopting states over whichever the corresponding time period is.
And then I can put some comments.
Yeah. Yes.
In terms of like GDPR laws, they're constantly changing. So I encourage you not to kind of gloss over the list of encounters and things that you can control for. Because I think it's really important in terms of like controlling for GDPR laws, odor, and environmental factors, and with the economic climate change in 2008, I think all of those factors are really important. And the further that you get from the inflection point,
I think that's a great point, and I think there's obviously a balance in any study like this between controlling for sort of as many things as we can control for and trying to get a sense also of how sensitive our results are to other changes that might be out there.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah.
Thanks for the great talk. I have many questions. Maybe this is totally out of my research. But I'm just wondering about what your thoughts are about the ignition of the box in relation to this expansion of automated driving. Is that something like that? Because you have a better sense of how these new technologies are changing.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but a friend brought it up to me the other day as well. I don't really have a sense of how quickly we're likely to have driverless cars on the road. It still seems like Back to the Future to me. This is technology that exists and we can use right now. And also just in terms of my prejudices, I'm less interested in driverless cars than I am in better public transportation around the country and other things that could help with this problem. But absolutely, you can drive a driverless car drunk without any problem. It would be awesome. I don't know. Yeah. So it's so interesting, and there's other people who know a lot more about how policy happens than I do. My impression from working with this is that it's a little bit bimodal. There's some states that are kind of virtuous states that we're always going to do stuff. You can imagine for yourselves what states those are. And then there's other states that are noticing and responding to a real severe problem in their own states. And those are states like New Mexico, which was a very early adopter of this and of other drunk driving measures, and they've actually seen a huge change in their state over time. So I think there's both camps. I think there's also probably something to do with what your neighbors are doing, and states having an influence on one another, but I don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think so, but go ahead.
It's an imputed value.
Yeah.
I'm wondering
whether
you did it with both outcomes imputed and
non-imputed. Yeah, so I left that out for time, but absolutely it's an issue. The FARS collects the blood alcohol tests from all drivers in any fatal crash, but not every driver is tested. They use a multiple imputation methodology to kind of fill in the gaps, and I was worried about that, so we did a couple things. The main thing was that we just tested overall crashes to like rule out any misattribution, and it was the same, which is reassuring. We also looked at, I don't think you can think that drivers are tested at random, so I was worried about only using the real test results. But I did look at states that have higher rates of testing and states, you know, just alone, and there's fewer states, so our power goes down, but the result is the same. So I was reassured by that.